February 2nd, 2005. This is the House Committee on Trade and Economic Development. The meeting will come to order. And we have the informational meeting this morning concerning the Jobs Plus program we have from the Department of Human Services. Dave Leider, TANF manager, and Phil Lehman, Jobs Field Representative. Would you please come forward, please? Thank you for coming this morning, and I appreciate it.
Thank you, Chairman Lim, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is David Leida. I am the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families Program Manager with the Department of Human Services. To my right is Phil Lehman. He's the Jobs Plus Policy Analyst for the department. I'd like to take a few moments today to talk about Jobs Plus. I believe you all got a copy of the Jobs Plus 2003-2004 annual report, and I'd like to review some of the history and program design issues explained in detail in the report. Jobs Plus grew out of ballot measure 7, the full employment program, which was passed by Oregon voters in 1990. Under the full employment program, recipients of food stamps, welfare, and unemployment insurance from 6 pilot counties would work in private and public sector jobs at 90% of the minimum wage in lieu of receiving those public benefits. The state that passed subsequently applied for waivers with the federal government. However, those waivers were not approved. In 1993, the Oregon legislature made some modifications to the Full Employment Act to make the program more closely comply with federal regulations, and subsequently in 1994, those waivers were approved and we began the pilot program in 6 Oregon counties. In 1995, the Oregon legislature expanded the program statewide. Under the original program guidelines, individuals who received food stamps, welfare, and unemployment insurance could be placed in private or public sector jobs and could be employed in those jobs for up to 6 months. And they would receive wages in lieu of the benefits that they would have otherwise received on those programs. Jobs Plus clients were paid at least a minimum wage and received the same benefits as other temporary employees with those employers. Jobs Plus employers were reimbursed for wages paid up to the minimum wage, payroll taxes, and workers' compensation costs. Jobs Plus employers, in turn, would pay a dollar per hour into the client's individual education account. These accounts could then be used by the workers after they obtained subsidized employment for education or training for themselves or their family members. At the height of the program in 1999, approximately 350 individuals entered the program each month. Currently, approximately 120 new clients earn a little per month in the program. Up until June 30th of 2001, Jobs Plus was administered jointly by Department of Human Services and the Employment Department. In July 2001, the two departments began administering separate programs. While the original guidelines around employer reimbursement and duration of those placements has remained relatively the same for the Department of Human Services program. There were changes made in these two areas to the Employment Department's program. Also, in October of 2002, the Department of Human Services program limited our enrollment to those folks that were receiving TANF welfare benefits. During the 2003-2004 program year, about 90% of the 2,199 clients served by the two Jobs Plus programs were Employment Department clients. At the end of December 2004, 308 people were active in the Jobs Plus program, of which about 125 were Department of Human Services clients. Within the Department of Human Services, Jobs Plus is one component of the existing Jobs Welfare to Work program. In addition to Jobs Plus, this program provides activities and services that help welfare clients enter the workforce. Jobs program's activities include such things as job search assistance, unpaid work experience, life skills, and basic education. It also includes services such as mental health, drug and alcohol, assessment and treatment, support services such as child care and transportation, family stability activities, and domestic violence assistance. Normally, Jobs Plus is used for clients who have not been successful in obtaining employment through those other jobs activities. Employment reimbursements are funded from both welfare and food stamp benefits and from the regular jobs program funds. A typical full-time monthly reimbursement amounts to about $1,400. This is made up, figured using current minimum wage at 40 hours per week, and we pay a little under 12% in various payroll and workers' compensation costs. Of this, about $850 comes from the offset of the food stamp and TANF grants. The remaining $550 comes out of the regular jobs program funds. Jobs Plus allows welfare clients an opportunity to be placed in a real job. It gives them a meaningful work experience and the ability to earn considerably more money than they would receive if they just received their normal TANF and food stamp benefits. The Department of Human Services Jobs Plus program also strengthens our working relationship with the local employer community. Phil, I'd be happy to answer any of your questions regarding the Department of Human Services Jobs Plus program. So I would open it up for any questions you might have.
Okay, Dave, any questions? Okay. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lehman, do you serve veterans? Have I got you mixed up?
Yeah, I'm Mr. Lehman.
Sorry. Mr. Lida, you were the one speaking at that moment?
Representative Nelson, Chairman Lehman. There may be veterans that are served if they are currently receiving TANF or if they're currently eligible for unemployment compensation, but I don't believe we have a separate program for veterans.
Okay, hold on. When you use the acronym, please use the full contents of the acronym and use it. Otherwise, someone might not able to comprehend what it means. Okay, what's the TANF means?
TANF is temporary assistance for needy families. Which that is the program that it used to be aid to families with dependent children. It's commonly known as welfare.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, follow up, please.
Follow up, please.
Would it be possible, Mr. Latta, to ask you to identify how many of these individuals are veterans?
Representative Nelson, Chairman, we'd be happy to go back and make an attempt to do that, yes.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Latta, on the program fact sheet that you presented, administrative costs are 33% for your program. And to me that seems remarkably high. And I'm wondering if it's possible to get a breakdown of what this administrative costs might be.
Representative Buckley, Chairman Lim, I believe you're making reference to the information from the employment department's
correct
stuff. I'm not prepared to speak to their information.
If I might add, Representative Buckley, when we instituted the Jobs Plus program on the Department of Human Services side, we already had a welfare to work program, the Jobs. We simply incorporated that program into the Jobs program, so there was no additional administrative cost for administering Jobs Plus on the Department of Human Services side.
May I follow up, Mr. Chair? I appreciate that. I'm still just trying to figure out where this number is that we're presenting with an administrative cost of 33%, who's responsible for that budget, and if we can have information provided to us of what those administrative costs are. The programs I've run through the different companies I've run, we've never had anything close to 33% of administrative costs, and it's a concern. I just want to make sure that our dollars are being used the most efficiently way possible.
And Representative Buckley, I believe the Employment Department is going to testify to this document.
Okay, very good. Thank you.
Questions? Okay. Is it possible that it seems like they're running two programs, one from the Employment Department, one from the Human Services Department? Is it possible that to make the administrative cost to reduce that? Is it possible you can combine it together somehow? Is it possible?
Chairman Lim, I would assume that that would be possible if that was the will of the legislature to do so.
Okay. And if you think that's the best way to administer of this program, and certainly we are going to do it. What is your opinion for that? How could we make it streamlining and work better?
Chairman Lim, I believe that the program was separated back in 2001 because the program has different rules for these different clientele. I made reference that while Department of Human Services program pays, reimburses employers the full minimum wage, and our clientele are eligible for services up to 6 months at a time, and Debbie Lincoln will be in to talk about the Employment Department program, but I believe their wage reimbursement is $5 per hour, and their duration is about 13 weeks. So we've got really kind of different rules for those two clientele.
I understand that.
In addition, there's different funding sources.
Okay. And sometime next week, could you come to my office and the both of you together? I want to come up with some plan how it's going to work better. If you could do that, let's discuss that coming to my office, okay? Please make an appointment my office, and I want to discuss both of you with Jim on this issue. Okay. What is the current enrolled in the Jobs Plus program at this time? How many are they right now?
Within the Department of Human Services program, I believe we've got about 125 clients that are active in the program.
I'm talking about the your department.
308 minus 125.
So about 308 are in the entire program, including those that are within employment department. John.
Okay. But what's the reason there has been thousands of people enrolled with right now? It's just a couple of hundred. What seems to be so dropped? Because of the funding? Because the program is not working? People lost interest in it? What seems to be the problem?
Chairman Lim, during a couple of periods in the last number of years, the Department of Human Services Jobs Plus program has had to stop enrollment due to shortage of funds. Once that occurred in between December of 2002 and September of 2003, and then again in July of 2004 through October of 2004. So currently we're in the process of bringing the program back from a dormant period.
Okay. Currently, how many people under the welfare role at this time, the federal and the state government welfare role in our state, how many are they now?
We have about, I believe, 18,500 families that are currently receiving temporary assistance.
Yeah, 18,000? Okay. That has been steady or going lower, is going higher?
Chairman Lim, that figure, I believe, is up about 5% from last year.
I didn't hear you.
I'm sorry, Chairman Lim. I believe that figure is up about 5% from last year. If we look at year over year.
5% higher or lower?
Higher.
Higher. Okay. If I remember correctly, 1990s, early 90s, we had about 100,000 people on welfare roll. I'm not sure that that's my remembrance. And then since then, steadily going down, it seems to me it's going up again. And what things we can do to reduce this welfare rolls in our state?
Chairman Lim, you're correct in that I believe the highest caseload level for temporary assistance for needy families was around 43,000 cases back in, I believe it was around 1994 period, which would have been about 100,000 individuals, because the average case, a typical case, would have a single adult, usually the mom, and two children. The primary tool that we have to help reduce that caseload is the general jobs program, which Jobs Plus is a component of.
All right, let's move on to the Mr. Phil Lehman of Jobs Field Representative. Welcome.
Thank you. I didn't have any testimony. Representative Lehman was just here to ask you any questions.
Oh, you don't have any testimony?
No.
Could you tell me what you are doing as a Jobs Field Representative? What is your responsibility?
As Chairman Lehman, as Mr. Light said, we have a jobs program. It's our welfare to work program that serves these 18,000 welfare cases, trying to get them off of welfare into work. My responsibilities is to work with field operations in the operation of that program.
Okay. All right. Any questions? Representative Buckley?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Quick question. I just want to make sure.
Is it you or who sends that?
It was all of us.
Okay, who from?
Just a very quick question. Mr. Lehman, just be very clear.
Sure.
You are an employee of the Department of Human Services.
That is correct.
I'm trying to get very clear who is working for you.
Yeah,
thank you.
That's correct.
Okay. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lehman and Mr. Lida, is there a requirement in the Welfare to Work program that if neither spouse is currently employed, that they must apply to be a part of the Jobs Plus program to get a job? Is it a requirement?
Representative Nelson, Chairman Lim, within the Temporary Assistance to Needy Families program, folks that are able-bodied adults are required to, and we call them mandatory clients, are required to participate in a jobs activity, not necessarily Jobs Plus, but in a jobs activity. If they do not participate in the program, as we set up case plans for each individual, if they do not meet the requirements of those case plans, they become sanctioned. And the sanction process is a six-step process, starting with, for the first 2 months, a reduction of grants of $50 per month. It then moves to the entire adult amount, which usually about $150 per month removed from the grant. And at the final levels, there would be a full family sanction, so they would stop receiving benefits. If folks get to that level, we do a case assessment to make sure there aren't child endangerment issues and those kind of things to make sure that the family would be able to survive without our benefits.
Okay, a quick follow-up, please, Mr. Chair. So by what you just said, since there is a requirement, then out of the 18,500 families, we'll just say 5,000 of them are adults or at least one spouse. So 5,000 of those have jobs. The 5,000 parents, I mean, one parent in each household has a job, or else they would be in your jobs program. So is that what you would have said?
Representative Nelson, Chairman Lim, the Temporary Assistance to Needy Families program has a what we call a basic program, which is for programs where there's one adult or no paid adult on the grant. And we also have a two-parent program, which we call the UN, or underemployed or unemployed program for two-parent families. About 90% of our families fall into the, or actually about 95% fall into the group that would be considered the basic population. Of those, over a third of those do not have a paid adult on the grant. So those would tend to be like caretaker relatives, or folks that are receiving Social Security benefits, where the parents are not citizens, but the children are citizens of the United States. Within those groups, there's about 9,000 clients that are clients being adults that are mandatory to participate in the jobs program.
Okay. Vice Chair Buckley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm still a little confused about these numbers. I think you just said that there were 9,000 people required to participate. When I'm looking at your Jobs Plus list here, this is for the 03-04, we're showing 2,000 under UI and 229 under DHS. So what am I missing between these roughly 2,000 people and 9,000 that you just referred to?
Vice Chair Merkley, Chairman Lim, the Jobs Plus program, if you will, is a component of the larger jobs program. So we have about, of our 9,000 folks that are participating monthly, you know, in the jobs program, roughly 120 are in that particular Jobs Plus component.
Okay.
Thank you. And when the numbers drop off so dramatically for DHS Jobs Plus after June 2000, was that federal funding issue or is that the state funding that changed, that led to that much lower level of participation?
Vice Chair Merkel, Chairman Lamb, I believe that was a state funding issue.
Did we get a federal match for the state funds we spent on this?
Vice Chair Merkel, Chairman Lamb, the jobs program, it's a combination of funding in that there's the temporary assistance for needy families grant, which is a block grant. So we get a certain amount of money from the federal government based on, I believe, 1994 expenditure levels. And we also match that with which is called maintenance of effort, which is the general fund portion of the program. So that's part of the funding. Part of the funding is from food stamps, which is 100% federal funds. And then the portion that we pay out of the regular jobs program is the same funding scheme as the temporary assistance to needy families grants. So it's part of that block grant and the corresponding maintenance of effort general fund.
Thank you. And before we go on, let me come up. Could you give me some kind of a data? If I'm unemployed with a family, the children of two, husband and wife and two, what's the maximum amount of they are getting, including the food stamp, health care, plus unemployment, whatever, all total, how much are they getting? And also, I try to compare, in case if they are on program, Jobs Plus program, and then how much they are earning. So if they are earning, not working, more than in this program, why should they work? So could you give me some the comparison, the same family, and what's the differences in the amount of money, totaled up together? Do you think you can do that?
Chairman Lim, if we were to look at just the paid benefits, so the temporary assistance to needy families grants and the food stamps, roughly that's about $850 per month. If folks are working, I don't have the exact figures, but I believe it's about, if at full-time employment, around $1,200 to $1,300 per month that they would actually receive. We've historically done some charts that compare folks that are receiving TANF to those that are working full-time, and I believe on a temporary assistance to needy families grant with food stamps, a family of three is earning roughly 69% of the poverty level, as opposed to that same family working a minimum wage job full time. It's about 130% of federal poverty level.
So why don't you give me some written information? I'm not talking about just the money only, including the housing, and if there's a health care. I just want to compare the whole thing, not just one portion of it, okay? If you could provide it, that might help us to understand better whether this program is going to work or not.
Okay. We would be happy to do that, Chairman Lim.
I do appreciate it. Okay. And Vice Chair Broom?
Yeah, thank you, Chair Lim. I just want to get a better feel or flavor, if you will, for the 9,000 adults that are, as I understand it, required to work under the state's current welfare laws. How much assistance does the state provide to follow through with that mandate? Meaning, if a mom or father or whomever is seeking a job to fill these requirements, is unable to find this job beyond what we're talking about with Jobs Plus, how much assistance does the state provide in finding that job or helping that person find that job as part of their requirement to work under the welfare laws?
Vice Chairman Bruin and Chairman Lim, in the governor's recommended budget, we provide, I believe, approximately $96 million per biennium for the regular jobs program, of which funding for the Jobs Plus program also comes.
So I guess my question is, of the 9,000 adults who are required to work under the welfare laws, there is a job. Period, I guess.
Vice Chair Bruin, Chairman Lim, when we say required to work, they're required to participate in jobs program activities.
Right.
With the end goal being that they find unsubsidized employment after we've assisted them with our program services.
Okay, thanks.
Representative Dallum.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And if I might pursue these numbers a little bit, starting, I think, just a few years before this, wasn't the movement in the department to move from welfare to work? And wouldn't this precipitous drop, some of it be an explanation of the success of that program to move off of welfare into work? Isn't that accounting for some? Is that accounting for some of the numbers?
Representative Dallum, Chairman, yes, some portion of that is we do have a shrinking population of folks receiving TANF assistance since the height of our temporary assistance needing families caseload back in the mid 90s. Probably the major reasons for these smaller numbers than the numbers that we'd had a number of years ago relates to the funding issue and the fact that we had to shut down or really kind of make the program go dormant for a period of time because of the funding issues.
Yes, sure. Okay. Representative Riley, did you have any questions?
No, thank you.
Okay. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess what I'm trying to understand is we have these great programs to get people working, but then why are we number one and two in unemployment? Do you not count these people because they're on the jobs program and the Jobs Plus program, or we only reach so few of our unemployed?
Representative Nelson, Chairman Lim, I guess I'm not really prepared to speak to the unemployment rolls. I think unemployment, my understanding of the numbers is that's a much larger population than those that we serve with the Temporary Assistance to Needy Families program. Certainly our jobs program should be able to help get more folks employed. However, I believe that especially for smaller families, if folks receive unemployment compensation, they will probably not be eligible for temporary assistance to new families, because usually those amounts would have them have too high of an income to actually be eligible for the temporary assistance for new families program. But for kind of general unemployment questions, I guess I would defer to
So, Mr. Chair, follow up. So, may I just be sure I understand what's being said? So, if an individual is unemployed and he is drawing unemployment, $800 or whatever a month, he cannot be helped to get a job by you. Is that true?
Representative Nelson, Chairman Lim, in some cases, in fact, in probably in most cases, that would be true. For a family, or a typical family of three, with the one adult and two kids, if folks receive more than, I believe it's just under $620 per month. They would be ineligible for temporary assistance for needy families because of that income level.
Thank you.
All right. And could you give me additional information? According to the chart you gave me, jobs plus placement results, it shows about 25,391 in placements. But what I want to find out, are they still working continually? Or what percentage they dropped out, went back to the welfare system, not working? Do you keep track of those people?
Chairman Lim, I believe the figure that you're making reference to is for the entire, both the Department of Human Services program,
exactly,
and the Employment Department program over the span of history. Within those that were served by the Jobs Plus program within Department of Human Services, we could certainly go back and try to identify of those who have been served by the program what percentage are currently on TANF, if that would meet your question.
Yes, I think that will be helpful, because we want to find out those people placed in the job, are they continue to work, or sometime later they just dropped out, went back to the old system. That's what I'm trying to find out, okay?
Representative Glenn, we have done studies in the past of the number of people who are on welfare, they've been in Jobs Plus, and then going out 18 months later to see if they were still on welfare.
Yeah.
And that figure is around, varies year from year, around 85% are not. So 15% would be, and 85% of those welfare recipients in Jobs Plus were not on welfare 18 months later.
Okay, when was the last figure, was it?
That was run 2002. Yes.
But that's a good high number. At least provide some information for us.
Right,
okay.
And we have that running back a few years prior to 2002.
Okay, appreciate it. Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you very much. And at this time, if there's no further questions, I'd like to call the Oregon Employment Department, Deborah Lincoln, the director.
And
right. Welcome, Deborah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Debbie Lincoln. I'm the director of the Oregon Employment Department. And I'd like to follow up a little bit on Mr. Leiter's and Mr. Lehman's testimony and describe what the Unemployment Insurance Jobs Plus program looks like, because the two programs are very, very different. They serve different people. They're funded with different types of money. First of all, I want to point out that though this started as a program out of the Department of Human Services for people who are on public assistance, unemployment insurance is not a public assistance program. It's an insurance program. It's not needs-based. It's not a social services program. It's insurance which is paid for by employers. I think that's a very important point to make. It's the people who are on unemployment insurance have a work history, a very strong work history, many of them, and particularly in this last recession, have a work history that includes relatively highly paid jobs. So we're looking at fairly different clientele for the two programs. I know there is confusion in the minds of folks who don't run these programs or aren't involved in them every day between the two programs, and I want to be sure that there's an understanding of the differences. As you saw in the material that Dave and Phil handed out, the report, there are unemployment insurance participants have now become about 90% of the program. So the Department of Human Services program is very, very small compared to the unemployment insurance program, which in itself is small compared to the numbers of people who are on unemployment. I will refer to the page that we handed out, and this is again the information just for the Unemployment Insurance Jobs Plus program, and try to respond to some of the excellent questions that you've had about this. The Jobs Plus Unemployment Insurance Program is funded by employer payroll taxes, a diversion from unemployment insurance taxes. What that means is that we lower the tax rate to an employer by a certain amount of money, siphon it off, and then from the unemployment insurance trust fund and put it in a special fund, and it has to be done legislatively. And that money is paid for by all employers in the state, about 103,000 we have on the tax rolls right now. In 2001, when the program was reauthorized and it was separated from the Department of Human Services program, the legislature authorized a $25 million diversion, which was to last for two biennia, to support the unemployment insurance program. When that money was exhausted, then we would have to come back and set up a new diversion, which again has to be done legislatively. That money will run out, or our authority to spend that money will run out at the end of this biennium in June of 2005. We had anticipated being able to spend all that. We have not. We probably will have about $1.8 million carryover. If we were to spend that $1.8 million into the next biennium, we would need authority, spending authority through our budget process, which we have not yet asked for through the governor's budget. When we set up a diversion like this, we do it in the statute by a specific percentage taken off of employers' payroll taxes. And so because of the recession, we raised quite a bit less than we expected. We raised closer to $21 million, $22 million. And then in the last legislative session, the legislature took $2.5 million of those funds and diverted them to the general fund. So we're down to about a $20 million pot of money for those 4 years in Jobs Plus. Again, to reiterate what Dave and Phil said, the Employment Department Jobs Plus program has a kind of a lower benefit level than the DHS program. We pay $5 per hour subsidy with no subsidy for any kind of benefits or other employment costs. And our folks are eligible for 13 weeks rather than the 26 weeks that the Department of Human Services Jobs Plus folks are available for. One thing that we both do is that after 30 days, the employer can contribute, does contribute, is required to contribute $1 per hour to an individual education account, which is set up for the benefit of the Jobs Plus participant or any family member to be used for 5 years after Jobs Plus. Only 17% of participants have used that individual employment education account over the life of the program. For UI Jobs Plus people, it accrues only $340, so it is really a relatively small benefit. Any money that isn't used over those 5 years then goes to the Student Scholarship Commission. But that is one benefit that was put into the program. We are not recommending a new diversion to support Jobs Plus. It's not a bad tool in our toolkit to get people back to work or to get employers interested in hiring new people. But there are a number of issues, and Representative Buckley pointed out one of the administrative costs are very, very high, unsupportably high, and any improvement in the program would simply increase those administrative costs. I'll point out, first of all, that the number of participating employers is 1% or less, so that we have very, very few employers taking advantage of this program that is subsidized by all employers, and the number of UI claimants is very, very low. Not quite 1% of UI claimants participate in Jobs Plus. The kinds of jobs that are generated by Jobs Plus tend to be the lower level, lower wage jobs. Employers are required to have a new job so that existing workers are not displaced by a subsidized job. They're required to provide some kind of training during those 13 weeks. We are unable, we don't have the administrative ability to audit so that we don't know how many of those companies are following those rules. So as our folks work to develop Jobs Plus placements, we try to keep a close eye on those. let's see, what else did I want to say? The placement costs for a Jobs Plus person tend to be fairly high compared to some of our other programs, of about $2,600 into a Jobs Plus job. We don't have real good numbers yet for the costs of the unsubsidized job which somebody ends up in after a Jobs Plus. We did a survey this past spring and summer of our Jobs Plus participants over the last 4 years, and note that though a number, most of them had jobs right after Jobs Plus, within 3 months, right after their Jobs Plus experience, only about 68% were still employed a year later. I'm not sure what that means given the economy. A lot of folks have been unemployed over the last 4 years, but it brings into question the efficacy of the program itself. That's the summary of the UI program. I hope I may have cleared up a little bit of the confusion between the two programs. If not, I'd be happy to answer questions on that or questions about anything else you have.
Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Chairman. Director Lincoln, just to make sure I'm following what you're saying, at this point you are recommending that the UI Jobs Plus program be discontinued?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Buckley, yes.
Okay. And in one respect, that seems like it would simplify matters just to have one Jobs Plus program to confuse the legislature with.
It's not just the legislature.
Employers too. And may I follow up one more question?
Oh, no.
And pardon me, because this is probably also addressed to the gentleman testified previously. I'm still trying to get the distinction between the two programs, and this is not, I guess, not for this witness, but I'd like to know what the overhead is, the administrative costs are for the DHS part of this program at some point, too. It's not a question to this witness.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Deborah, I perceive that one of the problems with this program is that we're not allowed to have these people fill unfilled positions for employers. I mean, I think it's ridiculous that we have all these openings, but these people can't work there because that's been a previously recognized opening at that business. Mm-hmm. Why don't we get rid of that stupid clause that we can't fill unfilled positions that were already established and put these people to work?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, we do have anywhere from 120,000 unemployed to this month, we're down to about 73,000 unemployed who are looking for jobs. The ability to subsidize an employer's payroll by other employers or by state government is relatively limited, and by allowing any employer to fill its unfilled jobs with publicly subsidized payroll really is not a fair way to run the jobs market. Our job at the Employment Department is to help employers and unemployed people, as well as people who are employed but are looking for a new or better job, get together and match those up. And our efforts, the bulk of our efforts, go into getting people into jobs that are not subsidized, that are permanent, and that are ongoing. I think our friends in the labor community were very, very concerned about perhaps taking a job that's available for a regular worker and filling it with a subsidized job, a publicly subsidized job placement.
Follow up, Mr. Chair, please. Well, I appreciate what you said, but I'm just going to ask you to let me know why we can't change those terms. And secondly, how on earth are these people going to get experience if we don't put them in jobs? You know, I was shocked to find out we cannot volunteer in a business in this state. I mean, if we have no skills, we can't volunteer. We can't work in a grocery store for a month or 3 months and say, just give me a chance to learn a business without being paid. So I don't look upon it as a subsidizing of the employer. I look upon it as an investment in an individual who wants to get ahead. So I think we need to change our thinking, and I hope your department will come back at how we can include more people and get rid of such clauses that restrict our people from getting good jobs.
Yeah. Besides you.
Okay. Okay. Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Lincoln, first of all, I want to commend you for not trying to continue a program that's not working. But my question is simply, can you give me a sense of how many unemployed folks are not on the unemployment rolls that have dropped off because and still haven't found a job? Do you have any clue about that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Riley, hold on a minute, I do. We have, again, the unemployment rate is calculated not only by the people who are actually drawing unemployment, but by people who continue to look for work. I mean, you probably know this. Look for work, but may not be for one reason or another on the unemployment rolls. And then there's a whole bunch of folks who have dropped out of the workforce entirely, perhaps women who have gone back to the home or something like that. We have about in calendar year 04 about 62,700 people who have exhausted all regular program benefits. In December of 04 we had 121,000 people still on the unemployment rolls. So I would say about half again as many people have exhausted and are not actually drawing unemployment as are currently on the unemployment rolls.
Thank you.
That's our 6.8% unemployment rate.
Just do you have those figures by county or by region?
Yes, Chairman Lim, Representative Dallum, yes, we do. We have an excellent, if you want to go straight to the web, it's our OMIS site. It's called qualityinformation.com. It's on our, you can get through it through our web page, but we will certainly get that printed off for all your regions. We can bring that into you. We have an excellent geographic information system that allows us to do that.
Just a brief overview. I certainly don't want to ask you for county by county representative, but if I may, Chairman Lang, a follow-up question. On a broad overview from a higher elevation, percentage that have quit looking and percentage of workforce out of work, is it higher east of the Cascades or west of the Cascades?
It's interesting. It's more county by county and east and west. For example,
Wasco County.
I thought you might be interested in Wasco County. I better not say right off the top of my head, but we will. I'll get to that. It's about really this recession, as you know, has been strange in that Northwest Oregon has had as much problem as Northeast had, and one of the Northeast counties, I believe, up in the around the Pendleton area particularly, has had a relatively lower unemployment rate than the Portland area. But right now, we're kind of coming into equilibrium. Everybody's in as much trouble as everybody else. Oh, thank you. Oh, thanks. Okay. We do have, for every county, we've got unemployment rates as for calendar year 03 plus the unemployment taxes that your employers paid in and the benefits your people got back out. So you can see what went in and what went out to your county.
I think until December, Oregon, until this last year, Oregon led the nation and Wasco County led Oregon?
Yes, Chairman Lim, Representative Dallum, Wasco County was at 10.7 for last calendar year. So I would guess that you led. Oh, no, Lim was at 10.9, so you were just. Oh, Harney was at 11.3. So
it is a very
sad story.
As we look at economic development, I want to be sure that we focus where the percentages are the highest.
Chairman Lim, if we could get a copy of that that she has, then it would be great.
I can ask somebody to run out and copy it right now and get it to you by the end of the hearing.
Thank you very much.
Thanks,
we can probably, Tamara?
We can probably take care of that. Why don't you go to our committee assistant? We'll call somebody.
Makes me crazy.
Right. Any other questions? If this UI program is not working well at this time, and also you are suggesting to discontinue, since we have such a large unemployment in the nation, why couldn't we make it better at working instead of discontinuing?
Mr. Chairman, as I said, it's not a bad tool to get people back to work, to get a certain type of person back to work. We think the money could be better spent in programs that affect a lot more employers and a lot more workers. Our general claimant reemployment program, for example, which is a more intensive case management of the UI claimants who are likely to exhaust benefits, would probably be a better use of the money. A big issue, if it wasn't a question of a new diversion and finding new funding for this money, we wouldn't recommend getting rid of it. But it is. It's a question of diverting employer payroll taxes into a program, and those funds may be useful, better used elsewhere if that were to happen. We could make it better, probably, but the administrative costs, I think, would go up because we would have to do even more case management, more job development of these folks.
Right.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you. I just, Mr. Chair and Deborah, I want to push this one more time. The entire philosophy of our temporary employment agencies, that are private, is to get an individual inside a business and ultimately, after 2-3 months, they would be hired full-time permanently for a job. Mm-hmm. So once again, I just, and having hired thousands in that very way, I just cannot accept what this statement says that, employers may not displace regular employees or fill unfilled positions previously established. To me, those unfilled positions, allow for an individual to be hired. So I'm with Chair Lim on this. I think we ought to clean up this program and take out these ridiculous clauses and do it right, or else turn all these people over to the private employment agencies and with these sources of funds and let them do it if we're not going to do it. I'm going to bet they're overhead in 33%.
Okay. Thank you very much. Maybe the next person might have some insight on this issue. And John Courtney, the president of Higher Calling Public Affairs. I understand you are associated with Jet Nguyen. What's the name of it?
Jet Nguyen.
Yes. Welcome.
Yes, thank you.
Chair Lim, committee, thank you. Thank you for taking the time today to look at this issue of Jobs Plus. It's not often that we get to chance to really educate and answer questions on some of the research that we've done. I do work with Higher Calling Public Affairs, and I am the president of that organization.
Can you speak closer to the mic so we can hear you better?
Yes. Sorry.
Thank you.
I previously worked with Jeldwin, and as you might know, Jeldwin was one of the original proponents of the program and initially proposed a ballot initiative in 1990 that passed with about a 60% approval rating in the state. I think you've seen the history of the program a little bit. What's circulating now is just an outline of my testimony. And it looks like I need a copy of that. I gave you my own copy. <Sorry. coughs>
Okay.
Just briefly to give you some background on the outline here, I think you've distinguished between the two different programs, and I just want to give you, I'll just skip to sort of big picture for you. This is an Economic Development Committee. I understand that's what you're looking at here. This article that called Why Piddle Around is an article that I wrote based on sort of taking a look back at the history of how we dealt with unemployment in the U.S. And if you think back to 1935, when Roosevelt put in the Works Projects Administration, it was a widespread get-back-to-work program. There were millions of unemployed in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And the idea was that people need work. It's good for them. It's not only good for their income, but it also affects them psychologically and socially in many ways. We've done some studies on that, and you'll find that the incidence of suicide, of spousal abuse, of child abuse, of mental illness, of alcoholism, of drug abuse, all are tightly correlated with unemployment. And that's the reason that we're involved with the program and promoting it. I'm going to talk a little bit later about some of the benefits to businesses and economic development, but we come from the standpoint of the people who are unemployed. From an economic development standpoint, what you find is that when you subsidize wages in a manner similar to what the WPA of the 1935 era did, what you do is you bring people who are looking for work who just can't find a job. We've tried everything, they've tried everything, and at the end of the day, they're still knocking on doors, and they're a little discouraged, or they're a lot discouraged. And they stop knocking, or they stop finding opportunities for whatever reason. It's at that point that we believe this state has committed in the past decade to give people a safety net. We're in an era where we're saying if you want to come for public assistance, or if you want to work within an insurance program, and you want benefits to help sustain your income, we expect you to look for a job and be looking for work. And I think that's what most people want to do. The problem is, statistically, we know the numbers. People don't always find jobs, no matter how hard they try. And many of those people in our economy are best served by on-the-job training, going to an employer, getting experience and some basic skills, and having somebody mentor them in a work setting. If you talk to employers, which I'm sure many of you have, you'll find that one of the number one problems employers will tell you they have with the workforce is that people don't have some of the basic skills. They don't know how to get to a job on time. They don't know how to work with their supervisor. They haven't developed some of these softer skills that maybe others have. These two programs, they're separated because the funding streams are different and the money we spend on them is different, but they're essentially targeted at the same people in the same way. They're designed to leverage the employers in our communities who are willing to train on the job and bring people along. That's all it is. From an economic development standpoint, I'll just give you a few numbers. We spend in unemployment insurance enough money to give people about half of what their prior wage was, right? Now, nationwide, I think the statistics are somewhere around half of the people in our nation don't have enough savings to last 3 months with a job interruption. That's not a lot of savings. So what happens when someone applies for unemployment insurance, for example? What they do is they start spending their savings, right? And we give them half their prior wage, and they start knocking on doors. But guess what? In Oregon, one out of two people who walk in the door and file for unemployment insurance, what happens to them? They exhaust. They run out of all of their benefits. Now, in a good economy, that's 6 months. In a bad economy like we've had the last 4 years, that lasts 9 months or 12 months. And so these people are unemployed for that period of time. And you can imagine what happens to them and their family, their savings. You can imagine how bad it is for them. So if we know in Oregon there are 160,000 people on unemployment insurance, and 80,000 of them are going to run out of all of their benefits, with our regular employment services trying to help them, the job board's trying to help them, them trying to help themselves, they're still going to run out. Their next income support is welfare. And now that's the track they're headed towards. Our theory here is, let's grab a portion of these that we profile the first day they come in. Let's identify them, which we do already, and every state does it under federal law. We give them a score and we say, how likely are they based on their job experience, their history, their education, their industry? How likely are they to go that 6, 9, or 12 months? Right off the bat, that's what we do. Week one, before they even get a check. So the question is, why wouldn't we grab some of those people and look to help them get a job, buy them a job, essentially, with a willing employer? Now, economic development impact comes where that person suddenly is now making twice as much money as they used to. The average wage, I think, is a little bit over $9 an hour in the program. So now there's twice as much cash in the economy compared to what they used to receive from unemployment benefits, right? They're also producing during that time. Employers just don't pay for people not to produce, right? I mean, among you who are employers, you're always producing with every employee. So now they're adding economic production to the economy that goes to your gross state product in every community. They're also paying taxes on their wages. Right? So we have a major impact on economic development here. The other piece about economic development is that in every community, we're not serving every employer in the state. But guess what? Every employer in the state has an opportunity to use this program. It's not discriminatory in any way. All you have to do is create a new job. And so in the past 4 years, on the unemployment insurance side, we've created something like about 7,000 or 8,000 new jobs. 7,000 or 8,000 new jobs. What programs do we have? I'm not fully schooled in economic development. I've studied a little bit, but how many programs out there are creating, guaranteed creating jobs in every community for every employer on a one-by-one employer basis, on a one-by-one individual basis? And not only creating a job, but creating a job for somebody who was going to fall off after 6 or 9 months and start using their savings. So from an economic development standpoint, I think it's a huge opportunity. The numbers aren't huge. They could be larger. 4 years ago, we scaled back the program by about a third. And when we did that, we cut back the number of people who were replaced. We cut back the number of jobs that were created here in Oregon. So that was a choice. We've studied the numbers since, and the results are pretty remarkable. I'm jumping all over the place. I'm sorry. I'm a little impassioned about this, but I wanted to cut to the chase for the things you might be interested in. There were a lot of questions, and I think maybe I can try to answer a few of them. Maybe we could just jump down to the welfare section here. In Oregon, since this program was adopted and realized that for the welfare folks, this is the backdrop, this is the safety net that goes along with the jobs program, which is your normal sort of we'll help you find a job program. This is when you have run out of all options, we're going to buy a job. So that component we believe is important because as welfare reform rolled out nationwide, you'll find that there were a lot of states that said, look, our new approach to welfare is 5 years out, we cut you off, and that's that. We don't want to hear from you. Your job is to be looking for work, being involved in work activities, and if you're not, too bad. We're cutting you off. That's our rule. I think it's a little unfortunate. And here in Oregon, we did things differently. We provided that safety net. And we said, we expect you to find a job. You need to participate. And guess what? We know that not all of you are going to find that job, but here's your safety net. And so hand in hand, these two components were used in Oregon to make Oregon a little bit unique. And in fact, it became a national model for most states. I also work with the American Institute for Full Employment. It's a nonprofit, and we consult with states around the country on these principles about how to run a program that not only sort of puts the right expectations in place, but at the end of the day, make sure that we're not just kicking people off the rolls. So that's why you'll find in Oregon that 68%, and I heard Mr. Lehman say 80% 18 months out had not returned to welfare. That is remarkable. That is stunning success in how this program has operated. You'll see a chart I passed around because I thought you'd be interested in context here. But it matches what happened in some other states. It's probably a little more dramatic than in some other states, but you can see, I unfortunately haven't updated this for new data, but I'll just show you where we are on this graph. The program was put in place, and you can see that when we changed our philosophy of changing from, we're going to give you a cash, and for the most part, we don't want to hear from you. You figure it out on your own, to, we're going to do everything we can to help you get a job and become self-sufficient. And guess what? When we do that, you'll go from one-third below poverty and welfare to one-third above. Dramatic change. So you can see the drop-off on the graph. You can see what happened in 2001. That was their decision point last time it was reauthorized. You can see the projected trend line continuing down, just the regular shaded area. And then you can see the line in the middle, the black line between the two striped areas. That shows what the governor projected at the time would happen to the caseload. And then you can see an upward swooping line. And that was the upward swoop that we expected if the entire approach in Oregon were reversed, which it looked like at the time it would be. What happened in reality was that the Jobs Plus program was retained. We had our safety net still to some level. It was carved back quite a bit. It was interrupted twice over the last 4 years. And where we ended up is right between those two lines. The problem is that's real families. We went up from a low point here in 2001 of about 15,500 families on welfare to over 19,000 now. I mean, that's, well, you know, percentage-wise, maybe that's not huge, or maybe not only that's not huge, but you talk to those families, that's huge. Those are people who weren't given opportunities. So that's a look at the welfare side. You can see some of the statistics here. 30,000 families came off welfare. 80% were staying off welfare. The second point is it raises welfare claimants' income from a third below poverty to a third above. The 90% who left welfare had not returned 18 months later. That must have come down with some recent data that I haven't seen to 80%. One in five surveyed of these former recipients who were working were now supervising others. To me, that was stunning. I thought these are first job opportunities, basic level jobs, but they grew to supervise others, which it was dumbfounding to me. Most who went to work under a survey were either satisfied or very satisfied with their approach. They weren't feeling like we're getting kicked off the welfare roll, as you might expect. And here, I suppose, for the economic development, for those of you who are looking at bottom line numbers, it saves about $11,000 per recipient given a job. So we spent about $11,000 more for all these people. So you can see that the tallies for what happens in the caseload. Again, if you're bottom line number people, you'll see a $20 million unplanned shortfall. That goes to general revenue funds. And so those are real budget impacts. Whereas the unemployment insurance side has its own pot of funds that don't hit the general revenue. But on the welfare side, they do. It's real impact. So if you're only concerned with money, just remember that. Keep this program, you're going to save a lot of money to the state budget. If you're focused on something else, all the other data is here. I'll stop for a minute and just see if there are some questions. I've been talking a lot.
Any questions? Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Some of the earlier figures that were given about unemployment sounded not quite the same as what I'd heard before. I wonder if it's possible to ask Director Lincoln to address that. Is that possible?
Yes, possible. Would you please come forward, please?
Director Lincoln, you heard some of the figures he used on the people who were on unemployment and who didn't find jobs. Could you comment on that for me?
It's a little difficult, and I think I lost track of exactly the figures he was using. Could you reframe exactly what it was that
Representative, are you asking about the number of claimants of the total pool who actually exhaust and fall off the end after 6 or 9 months?
Yes, and you said it was...
Right, I said it was roughly 160,000 for the total pool who file in any year, and then about half of those, a little bit under half, or around 80,000. Are falling off the end. I think it was actually a little bit over 180,000 because the more recent numbers are over 160, but it tends to be about half the pool.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Riley, in calendar year 04, we had 493,200 initial claims filed. So that's the very first claim. It's difficult to give numbers simply because of the extensions and all those kinds of things. I've got the things. We had, in calendar year 2004, we had 62,600 exhaust regular benefits. So those would be the ones I believe that John is characterizing as falling off. Let's see.
So that's about 12 to 15%. Is that 400,000 and 60,000? It's not anywhere near half. Is that?
It's not near. No, Representative Riley, it's not near half.
Representative, may I make a clarification, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
May I make a clarification?
Correct. Yeah.
Initial claims, and Ms. Lincoln, maybe you could further educate us. The initial claims, I believe, is a number that counts the number who actually come in and file, and they either are paid or not paid. It's a bigger pool. For first payments, which is normally what we look at, and those are who are actually paid for unemployment insurance, the number is quite a bit lower, and I don't have the figure that matches the 493, but maybe we have that here.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Riley, no, the initial claims are those claims that are filed, and we have to, we generally pay. I wouldn't characterize it the way John has characterized it. There are certainly people who end up not getting benefits, but that's a very small minority of the group.
Okay. Thank you, Mr.
Chair. Mr. Chair?
Representative Nelson?
Yes, could we just get clarity to that? I mean, could we really get, you know, the actual factual contractual data so that we can really know, are we putting people to work or, you know, they're still hanging out?
Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson, we'd be glad to put together a fact sheet for you on people who get work, people who have been unemployed.
And who are paid.
And who are paid.
Go ahead.
Unemployment. Most of our folks are unemployment for only a week. Less than 50% of them are unemployed for 8 weeks or less. But there's a high percentage that claim for a week and then get back to work right away. So we can give you some figures on that.
Mr. Chair. Yes. May I attempt to make a clarification?
Sure.
I think you'll find in most states what's called the exhaustion rate, which is based on number of claimants who are paid in the unemployment rolls. The exhaustion rate varies from about 30% or so up to a little bit over 50% of the caseload. And so initial claims is something different. I would like to see the data on our latest look at how many total claims were paid, and then I think you'd get a better percentage number. So I just want to let you know we're talking about some different numbers here. But the point behind the comment is we're still at 80,000 people who are falling off. So cut the percentage as exact as you want. We're 80,000 people that we're trying to serve.
That's ridiculous.
I'll take a further...
I think I lost my mic. I'll take a further slice for you just to give you to answer a question or a concern that this is not serving enough claimants to be worthwhile. First of all, I would say that any program that is helping the unemployed get back to work and saving the state money at the same time is a program you ought to keep. If it's net savings or positive, in other words, if it's a negative expense item, you ought to look at keeping it from a dollars and cents standpoint. Now, I can give you the figures for the amount of savings, but when you look at the numbers provided by the Employment Department today, the accusation is that our administrative costs are too high. On our calculations in the last 4 years, we've averaged a savings per person placed of somewhere between $1,000 and $7,000 per person saved. Saved, that's net savings. So if you're operating a business and your administration is costing you a third of what you're doing, that's something to look at, something to try to improve on. But it's not a reason to close your business. If at the bottom line you're making money on every transaction, your net profit is $1,000 to $7,000, expand the business. Go bigger. You've got a lot of money to earn. But incidentally, you've got a lot of people to help. Well, that's the more important point. So I wanted to address that issue. There were a number of other issues suggested for the unemployment side of the program, and I just wanted to address each one. First was the administration is high. We've talked about that. Second was that the number of employers served is low. We already talked about the fact that every employer is eligible to participate in the program. Incidentally, we find that small employers tend to be more involved in the program, and I'll just give you an example of why. It tends to be the small mom and pop, 2 to 3 to 4 employee employers who have a lot of risk if they add one more employee. They're not sure they can make payroll, especially in this economy. And so what they do through this program is they have an opportunity to take a little bit of a risk for 3 months and see if we put this person at the front desk and handling some of these things that somebody else had to handle, could that person then go out and make sales and be freed up to increase the business? And that's the type of risk that you find small business entrepreneurs making every day. And incidentally, that's the type of real opportunity I think as you have as an economic development committee. You know that all of, probably over 90% of your businesses in Oregon are small businesses under 50 employees. And so this is the way to tap into what they've got. Maybe a little extra time on their hands, but not enough revenue coming in the door. So they spend that time training somebody, and guess what? They get more productivity, and everything bumps up a notch. So the number of employers that it served, by my tally, is a little over 10,000. And I think we have something like 150,000 employers in the state. I don't have the exact numbers, but so that's 1 in 15 have been served by the program in its course of history here. I think that's enough employers to be served. It could be serving more. The number of claimants served is low. I'm going to give you a breakdown of the pool. We start with 160,000, we break to 80,000, and we get down there by excluding those who are attached. They're likely to go back. As Ms. Lincoln mentioned, there are employees whose employer says, look, I'm going to lay you off for a while, but within 8 weeks, you're coming back. Half of them tend to be that. So now you're down to 80,000 who really need our help. Take another slice and cut those in half for those who exhaust, who are going to run right out. Right, and of those people, if you're looking at maybe 40,000 or so, we're talking on an average of where this program hit its peak, right about 3,000 claimants. So hovering a little bit under 10% of those 40,000. I think that's a lot of claimants. I'd like to see more. I think we can do more. I think Representative Nelson had a suggestion I hadn't heard in this state before, but it's something that other states are looking at, and that is the key is not to displace somebody from a job. That's a tighter definition than let's just make sure it's a newly created job in the economy. Both rules work. Representative Nelson's suggestion, I think, would allow more claimants in. You'd have to guard against displacement. But I think the normal administrative procedures within the employment department would cover that. Every person who was laid off would come in, file for their normal claim, and they'd say, incidentally, I was booted out of my job because you put a Jobs Plus person there. Well, all the same procedures would apply for investigating the employer to see what were the causes for the layoff, as they do with every other layoff. And I think that would dovetail into our current situation. The last one is a low wage. The most remarkable data, if you want to focus on claimants, if that's your look, the most remarkable data we've seen came out this past year, the most recent report, and it said this. We know from past studies, if you file for unemployment insurance, your wage before you file compared to the job after that you get after you filed and taken your claim, there's an average wage drop for everybody. Average wage drop. So we're pulling out the people who are most likely to exhaust, least likely to have a chance in the economy, and we're giving them a job and getting them in at 80% rate. Guess what happens to their wages post-program? They increase. They don't drop like everybody else. They increase, and they increase by 15%. That is remarkable. I challenge you to find another program that does that. So I think, again, another area where I don't think the concerns with it are real concerns. I'll stop there and see if there are any questions.
Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Carden, you make a very good case for Jobs Plus program. Having studied it to the extent that you have, would you recommend a consolidation in some way? A previous assessment referred to confusion by employers. Right. Would it be to our benefit to have this administrated just by DHS, given the ability, at least on your fact sheet here, the wages subsidized for 6 months, apparently, from what you're saying?
That's correct.
Will it be to our advantage to have one program administered by one agency, clarity in communication with employers and claimants?
Representative Buckley, Chair. Lim, I think that's an excellent suggestion to take a look at that. I don't know administratively exactly which organization it belongs in or how they administrate it. Most effectively, I suspect that having one organization marketing the program probably makes sense. We had developed a brochure that basically showed employers, look, here's how everything works, and by the way, if you want somebody who's guaranteed to have recent experience, on unemployment insurance, which we don't have to talk about, right. Guaranteed experience, here's what you get, $5 an hour for 90 days. If you want somebody who doesn't necessarily have that previous experience, i.e. welfare, here's what you get. 6 months minimum wage. And we're trying to simplify it that way.
Good.
And I think that's an effective way to administer it. You can market to the same employers, the same concepts. It's just a matter of how much they need and how much they can give. Thank you.
Okay. We might be bringing back this issue again sometime in the future. Since the time is closing, 10 o'clock, we have another public hearing on the House Bill 2161, but before that I'd like to close a public hearing at this time, and I'd like to have a
closing information session.
Yes, closing the information session, and I'd like to open the public hearing and possible work session House Bill HB 2161. Thank you very much for your testimony. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Chair.
That's really helpful to us.
Chairman, House Bill 2161 abolishes the Oregon Capital Corporation. We have Mr. Floyd Lanter from the Department of Consumer and Business Services is the only person signed up for the hearing.
All right. Welcome.
Mr. Chairman, I might also mention the summary that I provided for the committee includes a lot of printed statutes. That's mostly what the bill does, is just eliminate statutes. Those statutes are not printed in the bill, however, and so I have printed those for your benefit.
Okay, welcome. Mr. Floyd Lenta from DCBS, Division of Finance.
Department of Consumer and Business Services. And please explain the history of this Oregon Capital Corporation, why we need to abolish this corporation.
Thank you. Chair Lynn, members of the committee, good morning. For the record, my name is Floyd Lanter, and I serve as the administrator for the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, a part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and I'm here this morning to request your support for House Bill 2161. The purpose of this bill is to repeal the creation of government authority that was granted back in 1987 to oversee the creation and existence of a vehicle known as the Oregon Capital Corporation. In 1987, the predecessor to the Department of Consumer and Business Services was charged with certifying a single entity to act as an Oregon Capital Corporation. The concept behind this and certification of this vehicle was to create an entity, capitalize at a minimum of $40 million, a maximum of $50 million, to invest in expanding or restructuring firms and entice entrepreneurs to obtain financing without sacrificing control, and to assist private financial institutions in providing venture capital to others. The laws were adopted in 1987 at a time when the economy really was in the tank across the country, and things were somewhat challenging in the financial markets. In fact, in 1987, the capital markets, as you know, had the largest one-day downturn since 1929. Money was really tight, and only the best blue-chip companies were attracting investors. And so the legislature addressed the problem by calling for the creation of this vehicle and hoping to attract investors with tax credits for 20% of every dollar invested in it. The department was to certify this vehicle or corporation, or if there was more than one group that came forward, to select the best candidate for it. After determining that it met the funding requirements and had a business plan that met the legislative intent. And when the law was passed back in 1987, it called for a corporation to be certified prior to July 1st, 1989. Obviously, that date's long gone. And there never was an Oregon Capital Corporation certified, nor even an applicant seeking certification. So the law appears to have been a law that was well-intentioned but did not have any practical effect, or possibly the economy of the early 90s made it unnecessary when things got a little better. In either event, the law no longer serves its intended purpose and creates responsibilities for the department that have not or will never come into play. So this is what we call a regulatory streamlining initiative. We'd like to get rid of the requirement. The bill is fee neutral, and we're not aware of any opposition to the bill. And I would respectfully request the committee support the bill and send it to the floor of the House with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Floyd, there's a critical need for a pot of money like this. So I get requests, probably one, at least one a month, a business starting up, wanting to know where they can get funds. So what has replaced this, and where would people get the benefits that are outlined here?
Chair Lim, Representative Nelson, yes, there is a need for venture capital funds, and I think the need is being met primarily through the private sectors and people who are putting their capital funds at risk for these types of ventures. I typically want control over their investment, and as such, I think that's the reason this never did materialize. That's just my speculation, but...
Members, if I might interject some information here. The Oregon Investment Council now has some responsibility for doing this type of investing. They are going to be here at your meeting on Monday to talk about that.
Okay. So we will have more information on this issue. Monday we call the Oregon Investment Council. Are we inviting also the Oregon ORTDF?
Yes, the ORTDF is an old fund that was funded out of lottery money many biennia ago, and it has changed form at least a couple of times, and now I believe is under the jurisdiction of the state treasurer, and that's who's going to be here on Monday.
Okay.
Joe,
Representative Riley.
Thank you. If you could follow your own rule and tell me what that acting in means.
I know I can tell you about that.
ORTDF is the Oregon Resource and Technology Investment Fund. It was an effort to take public money and work to invest it in emerging companies that had some sort of technology that we thought would be good for the economic development of the state. Originally, it was funded through lottery money, and as you know, there have been a couple of things since then. I don't have the names of them, but that's what ORTDF stands for, and the state treasurer will be here on Monday to try to dig me out of this hole that I'm getting myself into.
So the state legislature was created this institution some time ago for a venture capital to boost, and some success stories out of it, and we will hear that next Monday.
Good, thank you.
Okay, Representative Buckley.
Chairman Luna, I move that we support this bill and send it to the floor.
Okay, and we are going to do that after we close a public hearing.
I'm sorry.
If there's no public hearing, we will close the public hearing, and I open the work session on House Bill 2161.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Buckley, since you
jumped the gun, my apologies, yes. Mr. Chairman. I move that we support this bill and send it to the floor with the pass recommendation.
Okay, any discussions?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Nelson?
I'm sorry that Representative Buckley beat me to the motion.
Okay.
Because I think it's very difficult to make this decision until we hear that there are other avenues through which we could support individuals in our state with economic development monies. And I would like to know if the $40 million was ever placed in this.
No, there was none.
Yes. Fund ever?
No.
Not $1 ever?
Not ever.
But the concept, as it appears, is very sound, and not knowing the concept of the other investment funds, I would want to table this motion.
All right.
So that would be a motion to table.
Motion to table?
Ask her if that is a motion to table.
Is that you are asking to table the motion?
Yes, sir.
All right. So any discussions
for that?
You would need to... I don't know what the table of the motion is. It's a debate of the motion.
What's the rule say?
We can stand at ease and find out, or if you'd like to go ahead and debate the motion, you could.
Okay, so any discussions? The Vice Chair Muckley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm comfortable with this bill because in the time that has passed since the late 80s, when private capital was extremely scarce and interest rates were very high, and therefore diverting money more into interest vehicles, it's been superseded, and we've had an effort to take the state investment fund, which I'm sure we'll be learning more about next week, and create a venture capital component of it, which we did last session, and I believe that's fully up and operating. There probably isn't any harm in holding this bill in deference to if Representative Nelson still has concerns about the picture, but my understanding is this is pretty much a housekeeping relic, and when the need occurs in future years to reinvent something like this, then probably best to get it off the books between now and then, just for the sake of not diverting the attention of the department unnecessarily to this piece. So I support the bill, but I'm comfortable waiting if Representative Nelson would like to get more information on it.
OK. Okay, any other discussions?
I believe that the Representative Nelson has a reason, and maybe not to table it, but more information on this issue. And so I will hold on this bill until the next time. There's another companion bill comes with it, so we can discuss it at the same time. So we have more time out of our respect to you. So I think that's a prudent way to do it. It's not emergency. We need to pass it at this time. So what do you think?
You might want to ask the two members who've made motions if they would withdraw their motions, and I think that would be a cleaner way of just closing the work session on this issue.
How do I do that?
ask the members if they would like to withdraw their motions.
Withdraw the motion.
Withdraw the motion.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman?
And
I would like to withdraw my motion in deference to Representative.
Thank you very much.
And Mr. Chairman, in deference to you, I will, and to Representative Buckley, and this fine committee and great administrator, I will, and assistant, I will remove my motion.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, at this point you have no motions pending, and okay. You could close the work session pretty cleanly and come back another time for a work session on this bill.
Since she's withdrawn the motion, could we have a work session at this time?
I think you're at a good point for continuing the work session to a different date, if you would like to.
Well, I believe.
Or you could continue discussing it if you wish.
Okay, I think we will close the work session at this time. We will come back the next with another companion bill. But we had a good discussion.
Yes.
All right. With that, if there's no further business on this committee, then the meeting is adjourned until next Friday. What time?
Yes, I wanted to mention that we are...
All right? Thank you. We didn't know that. Thank you very much for waiting. Yes.
My name is Dan Lidstrom. I have a mailing address of Prangell, Oregon. I'm new to this stuff, but on HB 2161,
yes.
It says the heading above it says public hearing and work session. Uh-huh. And I know the work session is for you people figuring out how to run the government. And I don't believe there's any private input on that. And that's why I just wondered what the public hearing was. It just to listen? Okay.
I might mention that for a public hearing, we put out a sign-up sheet, and we ordinarily ask people to sign up, and then I bring the sign-up sheet to the chair, and he calls the names that are there. Sometimes the chairs will ask if there's anyone else who wishes to speak. And on this one, my advice was that because it was a pretty simple bill that they could go ahead with the work session. So, you know, as the committee administrator, it's probably my fault that we didn't call for additional testimony, so I apologize.
But a simple bill to delete it?
No, it is not deleted. We will bring it back.
And do you need
to look at it again?
Yes.
Because then I heard if it was deleted, then it could always be brought back at another time if we needed.
It is not deleted. We only just postponed it.
The work on it.
I believe what you're saying is, could this this commission be brought back at a later time, as the vice chair suggested, if it's needed in the future? Is that what
that was kind of the question?
Yes, of course.
So when the bill is fee neutral to delete the Oregon Capital Corporation, if you brought it back, would you have to do all the work that probably is represented in 2161 or the whatever the Oregon Capital Corporation bill number was?
Mm-hmm. I might be able to comment on that. I think the Oregon Capital Corporation was an idea that was created by the members and the legislature in 1987.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think anyone has looked at the specifics of that bill to find out whether it is still applicable. In that bill from 1987, it had a procedure for certifying this corporation, and it had a deadline. I don't know how hard the deadline was, but it said this corporation was to be created within 2 years, and that would have that time expired in 1989. As I mentioned to the committee, there have been succeeding efforts to do this sort of thing, to provide public money for investment. The committee will hear on Monday, and I hope you'll come back on Monday to hear about how that is being done. I think after the committee hears that, they may know more about whether this sort of corporation is feasible these days and could be rewritten or modified so that there could be another try at this corporation. This type of corporation, or if there's sufficient programs already set up to do this currently without the corporation. That's what will take place over the next week in this committee, I'm guessing.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Nelson?
And Mr. Lindstrom?
Yes.
I believe if you wanted to make a statement, couldn't he make a statement of on the bill of whether he thinks we should keep it or not keep it? That would be okay. You could go ahead and do that today.
Well, my statement or question would be, if it was set up in 1987, well, it was a laborious process to get all the paperwork, and then no one took it up, so then now we're going to delete it. But if something like that was needed in the future, would it be a laborious or hour-consuming project to get all this paperwork written up into law with the hope that someone would take up the position of an entrepreneur promoting or a job promoting or a business promoting adventure or...
Mr. Lindstrom, that's a very good question, and in my opinion, Mr. Chair,
yes,
continue. Sorry, that is something that we'll need to consider, and it's what I understand now will take place on Monday. We will consider if we do need to keep it. So, in the event that we think we might need it again. We would already have the shell set up, or as the administrator said, we will verify on Monday if there are other funds, and I had the same question as you do, that can take the place of this.
Okay. All right, thank you for bearing with me.
Thank you for coming.
Appreciate it. All right, we'll close the public hearing and the meeting is adjourned until...
Well, we have the field trip on Friday, so our next official meeting would be on...